You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you up to date on the news that made headlines around our area this week. And today, our panel includes Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News, Margaret Carmel with BoiseDev.com, and Nick Geranis with the Associated Press in Spokane, as well as Keith Ridler with the Idaho Associated Press. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hi, Gemma.
Happy Friday.
So before we get into the program, we're actually looking for some listener participation for Monday's show. We know so many people all over the country brought a new pet into their homes over the last year, these pandemic pets. So if this was you, we want to hear from you. Did you welcome maybe a pandemic puppy or a quarantine kitty into your family? We would love to see photos of those furry friends. So email us a picture with your animal. Here's the address, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. And then make sure you tune in on Monday when we will talk about the boom in pet adoption during COVID. But now let's get to our Friday Reporter Roundtable. So some news coming out about, I mean, really a horrific and tragic story that happened in Idaho in the mid-2000s. And this is that serial killer Joseph Duncan died in federal prison earlier this week. He did die from cancer. And Nick, you covered this story from the very beginning. You are in Spokane, as we mentioned. This happened outside of Coeur d'Alene. For folks who are not familiar with Joseph Duncan, can you kind of give us a history of this?
Sure, I can. Duncan was a registered sex offender who spent most of his adult life in prison. And in 2005, he was driving down Interstate 90 near Wolf Lodge area of Coeur d'Alene. And he saw the two of the Groney children playing in the yard of their home, which was right on Interstate 90. And he pulled his car over and he stalked the family. He broke into the house at night using night vision goggles. He beat the mother, her boyfriend, and the mother's 13-year-old son to death with a hammer. And he kidnapped the two youngest children, Shasta and Dylan Groney, and took them into Montana to a national forest where he tortured and abused them for weeks. About 6 weeks after the slayings, Duncan and Shasta, who was the only survivor of her family, were spotted at a Denny's restaurant in Coeur d'Alene in the middle of the night, and they were spotted by the staff and rescued by police.
And then Joseph Duncan was later, I mean, charged. He was convicted, correct? But
yes, charged and was convicted and given the death penalty.
And during this time, Nick, I mean, also other things came out, because when we say he was a serial killer, I mean, he was linked to other murders across the country, correct? When this happened with the Groney family.
Yes, it turned out in the brief periods of time that he'd been out of prison, he was very busy. He was charged and convicted of killing a 10-year-old boy down in Riverside County, California. And he confessed to authorities to killing two young girls in the Seattle area at the same time, again, in the mid-1990s, I'm sorry. And then it turns out, though, although there was suspicions that he might have had more crimes on his docket, the prosecutors told me this week that they do not think that there was anything else that he was involved with.
Hmm. And so he did die this week, and it was cancer, correct?
He died of brain cancer at a hospital in Terre Haute, Indiana, which is right near the prison that houses the federal death row.
And I know, I mean, Nick, being a journalist and covering a story like this is always difficult. No question. I mean, it is truly, I think, one of the most horrific crimes that I think happened in Idaho. And I mean, you have children; they were young at the time, and your children remember this as well, correct? I mean, just from because it was, I mean, it wasn't just Idaho news. This made national and international news.
Yes, it made national, international news. It really struck a nerve with a lot of people because of the sheer brutality of it. But my kids, we make frequent trips from Spokane to Montana when they were younger to visit family. And my kids, when we drove past the house, which you could see clearly from I-90, would always remark that that was the Groney house. Mm-hmm. And years ago, the house was torn down, you know, so no one else would live there. Mm-hmm. And when we drive past and I'm with one of them, they will inevitably say there was where the Groney house was. It made such an impact on.
And speaking of impact, I mean, Kevin, you know, even as journalists, sometimes we get called for civic duties like jury duty. Talk about your connection to this.
It's a minor personal connection, but it's a very, you know, it still kind of sticks with me. I was part of the large jury pool, it was called, in Boise for the sentencing phase of the Duncan trial. And there were probably about 300 of us who were called that day. And I was out within the morning. That there was a fairly large pool of prospective jurors, as I recall, that were excused right away. And I was in that first group. And I am to this day so thankful that I was spared that duty. I mean, I think a lot about the jurors and what they had to try to process and what they're still having to process years later, having mm-hmm. heard it. You know, if you're going to ask jurors to make the most serious decision a juror can possibly make, you know, to sentence somebody to death, they have to hear about these crimes in excruciating detail. It's the only way they can process the decision that they're being asked to make. And, you know, this is one of the beauties of our legal system is the concept of the, you know, trial by a jury of your peers. And, mm-hmm. but the problem, the pitfall to that is that you're asking, you know, everyday people, you know, everyday law-abiding people to listen to this kind of depraved, psychotic criminal behavior and to try to process it and then, you know, move on with their lives. And, you know, this has been a traumatic case for first responders, for attorneys who deal with this kind of thing, maybe not in this magnitude, but deal with crime on a daily basis. I mean, for the jurors, I can only imagine what they went through at the time and what they're going through at this time and what they're going through to this day.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we should also note that as Nick mentioned, Shasta Groney was the only survivor of this. And you talk about trauma and how this has impacted someone's life forever. So, you know, remembering her as you know, this chapter is closed, yet she will bear the scars of this for the remainder of her life. And we only hope that that she can carry that and continue to move forward with her life. So I am going to change gears now because there is other news to get to. And Keith, I'd like to bring you into the conversation because you have been doing some reporting in regards to radioactive waste. And can you talk about the plan to bring radioactive waste to Idaho?
I did a couple stories in the last week involving radioactive waste in Idaho, which is always kind of a big thing in Idaho because the state very nearly became the nation's nuclear waste repository back in the 80s and 90s before Governors Cecil Andrews and Phil Batt kind of tag teamed and through some lawsuits and finally an agreement kind of prevented that from happening at the Department of Energy site out in eastern Idaho. So whenever there's a nuclear waste story, I usually try to write about it. This first one, the one you're talking about, has to do with a different site. It's the U.S. Ecology Idaho site. It's about 60 miles south of Boise. They've taken a lot of hazardous waste but not typically this type of waste they're getting this time, which is from Westinghouse Electric Company's Columbia Fuel Fabrication Facility in Columbia, South Carolina. They're cleaning up that site. And so about 5,200 cubic yards of sludge and debris from, you know, generated from uranium recovery. It's contaminated with low enriched uranium. That's going to come to Idaho. That's about 430 dump truck loads. Then about 525 obsolete steel cylinders used to transport nuclear fuel. That's also planned to be sent out here. It'll be sent by rail car and truck. And that's the Nuclear Regulatory Commission just recently had a series of public notices. The most recent one approved this final part of the deal. And it included an environmental study. So the commission signed off on it. One of the interesting things here is that the U.S. Ecology Idaho doesn't typically take this type of radioactive waste. It does take some, mm-hmm. but for this type, the commission had to issue a waiver, which is interesting. So that is all scheduled to ship out toward Idaho here at some point.
Huh. You know, Keith, it's really interesting because you bring up what you said back in the 80s and 90s. And I remember being a baby reporter back in the late 90s when all of this was going on in eastern Idaho. And so I think any time a radioactive waste story comes up, for those of us who can remember that far back, you know, I mean, I automatically assume it's something like that, but this sounds fairly different. But at the same time, when you talk about the environmental impact study, you know, those weren't being done 20, 30 years ago.
No, nothing. Yeah, that's in fact, the other story I wrote involved the Idaho National Lab, the Energy Department site out in eastern Idaho. It's 890 square miles. And a lot of people believe it would be a nuclear waste repository right now, except for the court battles Anderson Babb engaged in, and finally the 1995 agreement. The story I wrote about that, that started in 1949 and during the Cold War era,
wow.
like I said, before there were any environmental standards or really concerns for that matter. There was a lot of nuclear activity going on out there. I mean, they built 52 reactors. And back then, I mean, they had injection wells that, you know, put stuff into the ground. So of course that reached the aquifer. There were unlined pits, all kinds of things. And in 1989, it was designated a Superfund site. And as part of the 95 agreement, which is really one of the more significant documents in Idaho history when you think about it, gave Idaho quite a bit of say over what goes on out there with involving nuclear waste, what comes in, and a lot of it has to go out. In fact, there are deadlines for it to go out. But as part of all this, the Superfund designation and some of the court battles, and this one's involved a 91 agreement, there's a review every 5 years of how the cleanup is going. So I wrote about that. And in generally the review said that their cleanup is going pretty well. It's a 450 page document. It looked at places like the Advanced Test Reactor, Test Oregon North. There's this tank farm facility, which appears to be kind of the worst of it. They had a pretty big spill in 1972. That involves they're transferring radioactive sodium-bearing waste, about 19,000 gallons spilled. So they're still working on that. They're not expected to be done until 2095, at which point they'll put a cap over it. And there's some other areas as well that they're trying to clean up. Test Area North they're putting in a pump and treatment technology, and they're putting in a new well. They're hoping microorganisms will help break down some solvent that's in the ground there. And it's pretty significant work going on out there, and probably because it's that area sits atop the Eastern Snake Plain Aquifer, a Lake Erie-sized mm-hmm. aquifer. It provides water to farms and cities in the region. And I know I used to interview Governor Cecil Andrus. He passed away in 2017, but he would always say if that aquifer ever became, you know, badly polluted, nobody would buy potatoes from Idaho because, you know, who would want to get a radioactive potato? So that was
right,
his
exactly.
kind of yeah, big argument. He was, and he, you know, he knew how to work the press and give us good sound bites. So,
yeah, so there's that. Yeah. Well, let's take a quick break and we'll have more with our reporter roundtable next. Continuing our conversation with our reporter roundtable, our panel today, Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News, Margaret Carmel with BoiseDev.com, and Keith Ridler with the Idaho Associated Press. So the legislature reconvenes next week after taking a break because of a COVID outbreak. And Kevin, I think it's fair to say that there's a lot that they need to get to in this unprecedented session.
Yeah, it's going to be a race to the finish, and I don't really know how long it's going to take them to get done because they have so much to get finished. I mean, they still have to run a lot of budget bills, including all of the public school budget bills, and the higher education budget still has to go through the House, and that could be a real fight. You have a big debate over tax relief. The House has passed a version of tax relief. The Senate has not taken up the issue, so we'll see where the two houses, we'll see how the two houses come to terms on a tax relief package, transportation. And, you know, there are a lot of policy bills that are still kind of waiting just in the education sphere, whether we're talking about the early education grant bill or, you know, grants for parents to pay for the cost of online learning, to sex education, to guns in schools, to all-day kindergarten. All of these issues have come up in the past few weeks, and all of them are unresolved. So depending on how much this legislature wants to bite off in these remaining days and weeks, it's going to be a busy session, and it could be, you know, it could take, you know, 3 weeks or so possibly for the legislature to finish all this work.
Right. So we could be the end of April, 1st of May before.
Easily. We could easily be looking at the end of April.
Yeah. Hey, tax Margaret, relief. Go ahead, Margaret.
I was going to say the tax relief issue really should not be overstated because that's the number one issue a lot of people are hearing from, you know, from Idahoans is property taxes are spiking. And the last, you know, in last session, there was a lot of debate over how to address the problem, and they came away with no changes. There's people in the House that are, and others like Senator Rice from Caldwell and House Majority Leader Mike Moyle, who are really in favor of let's cap local government budgets and try to reduce the amount that they might need to be increasing in collections. But others are saying that solution will not be enough because it doesn't address the shift in values onto residential property and away from commercial property as our housing market explodes. And so proposals like from Representative Skog from NAMPA to reintroduce indexing the homeowner's exemption or even increasing it a little bit have met with resistance. And instead, you know, the House's package is really focused on cutting the income tax, which some analysis says would mostly give more relief to higher income Idahoans and not nearly as much to people on the lower end of the scale. I think there's a lot of pressure on the State House to come away with a deal this session after they did not come to a conclusion last year. And so I am really curious to see what's going to happen because that is a major issue.
So Margaret, are there any rumblings then of any new property tax proposals being put onto the table when the legislature reconvenes?
I've heard some rumors that they do intend to return with a deal and start talks again on, you know, day one, as I heard Garden City Mayor John Evans say in a meeting with the Ada County Commissioners. But I think the exact proposal is still up in the air. Senator Rice's bill that would have capped local governments that went through three amendments. I mean, it was as amended. When they finally argued it on the floor, it lost by one vote in the Senate the same week that they decided, you know, before they went on their break. And so I'm curious to see I've heard that some sort of bill that is similar to it might, you know, come back up in the House, but we really don't know at this point. But I do think that they want to get a deal done on property taxes. The question will be, is it going to be legislation that is going to be focusing on, you know, providing cash relief for low-income homeowners and, you know, people on fixed income, giving more help with the homeowners exemption, or is it going to be focused on local government taxes? Because the local governments are not happy about that proposal, because a lot of them, especially in high growth areas like Meridian, Star, and CUNA, are saying that without, if they can't take those new, you know, taxes from new construction and take in those extra collections as the area grows, they're concerned that they might not be able to keep up with the infrastructure. And that's putting a lot of pressure on the State House, because you've got Democratic mayors, Republican mayors, everybody calling into their representatives and holding press conferences saying, don't do this. This could kneecap us. And so I think that whatever they decide is going to be a really major piece in how Idaho is going to be navigating its growth for the next decade or more.
Yeah. And then, Keith, in the midst of all of this, the governor issued his first veto of the 2021 legislative session just this week.
He did. If I could just mention about the property tax bill, though, the one that lost 18-17, there were lawmakers who got up on the Senate floor, Senator Fred Martin, for example, Chuck Winter as well. They said they were for property taxes, but that wasn't a property tax bill, they said. And so they voted it down. So I think Margaret is exactly right about what she said. I mean, those were their main concerns as well. If property tax comes back this year, it's hard to believe that it will actually, even though there's talk about it. There's just not that much time left, a lot to do. But yeah, the governor did issue a veto, and kind of just came out of, a lot of people didn't really see it coming because it was a bill involving the Idaho State Tax Commission, and it passed the House 66-1 in February, then the Senate 23-9 in March. So it obviously didn't draw a lot of concern. I'm not aware of anybody who reported on that bill as it worked its way through. So when the governor vetoed it, everybody had to take a minute to look at it. The governor who's kind of staked his reputation on being a, you know, cut red tape kind of guy. And he said this particular law would increase the red tape. He said it was his quote, a burdensome level of bureaucracy. What he's essentially saying is, what the bill would have done, it would have given the tax commission, there are four people on it, the chairman and three commissioners, it would have given the commissioners much more say. They could have asked for a vote on actions by the chairman. It also would have required their approval on some administrative actions by the chairman. Basically what Little was saying, that led to too many cooks in the kitchen. He wasn't gonna have it. When I wrote that story, I texted the Senate President Pro Tem, you know, Chuck Winder, to ask if they might veto it. Also, I sent a text to House Speaker Scott Bedke. Neither of them responded the day I did the story. The next day, Winder said he didn't know if they would or not. But now that it's been vetoed, I think it's much higher on the radar for a lot of lawmakers. They're going to really look at this in a much more critical way and think about it.
Right.
It might even also have to do, this is an executive branch agency, of course, the legislature, all session has been trying to limit the executive branch power with various bills. This might be part of that as well, although there's some more history. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see if they try to override this veto.
Yeah. Kevin, can you talk about, you mentioned in the beginning of this segment about so many of the things the legislature has to get done in regards to education in particular, but there are some school districts that might be concerned because the legislature could withhold some funding, but we're talking federal funding, right?
We're talking about federal funding, and it is so easy to get mixed up which federal funding we're talking about, because we've had three federal stimulus laws that have infused millions upon millions of dollars into education. We're talking about the law that was passed in December that basically gives K-12 about almost $200 million. Most of that going to the school districts based on a formula that is roughly based on the poverty levels of a district. So at any rate, the legislature has decided to give the districts access to about $104 million of this money. And that leaves tens of millions of dollars on hold until after July 1st, after the beginning of the new budget year for school districts, new budget year for the state. Some districts are saying, hey, hold on, we were expecting more of this December payment, this December influx of federal dollars. This is going to create a cash flow issue for us in this budget year that runs until June 30th. So at this point, we don't really know how this is going to get resolved. There's a possibility that the State Board of Education may step in and provide some funding for the districts that are really facing a cash flow issue. So this is very much an unresolved issue, but and we aren't even talking about the $400+ million that school districts will get from the most recent coronavirus stimulus law, the one that was passed just a few weeks ago.
Right, exactly.
I mean, it's a huge influx of money that all of these school districts will have, and will have several years to spend. So, I mean, it's going to be a big job for us in the years to come to just sort of follow all of these dollars and figure out where it was spent and what kind of impact did it have on students and what sort of impact did it have on student success.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Margaret, let's get out of the legislature for a minute and talk about an interesting story that you did recently in regards to evictions. As we know, with the pandemic, so many people were impacted, losing their jobs, some people being concerned, of course, about losing where they live. What did you find out about evictions here in Idaho in the last year?
So Boise State University did a study of evictions, and they found that the numbers actually dropped 30% around the state since 2019. And there's a number of reasons for this. And it's really, a lot of it goes back to the rental assistance that was offered to people through these federal assistance programs that is ongoing, as well as, you know, additional unemployment benefits, the stimulus packages, as well as, you know, just delaying hearings. You know, you saw the biggest mm-hmm. drop in evictions come in the month of April, whenever the courts decided to delay a lot of eviction hearings that were for non-payment of rent, as opposed to, you know, someone destroying a property or criminal activity on a property. So those hearings were delayed, and that, you know, slowed the numbers down. The CDC did issue an eviction moratorium that was pretty broad in September, but for people that were impacted by the pandemic who made under a certain amount of income. But the thing about that eviction moratorium is that it wasn't really enforced in Idaho, and a lot of the guidance was pretty vague, leaving it up to the states. So some states were pretty tough about enforcing it, others were not. And in Idaho, I talked to nonprofit partners that have been representing low-income Idahoans, and what they told me was they had way more success in preventing evictions with rental assistance, deliberation, other types of negotiation, as opposed to using this moratorium, because all it did is just it just caused conflict. Something else that I have heard from people is that anecdotally is that if folks basically found out that they, you know, had lost their income, they're worried about losing their house, they fill out the proper paperwork in order to take advantage of the moratorium, give it to their landlord saying, hey, I'm eligible for this. And then the landlord would say, okay, you're on a month-to-month lease now, and you're month-to-month. And then that means the moratorium no longer applies to them, and they don't evict, but they just say, okay, won't renew you. You can't pay, I won't renew you. And so there's been a lot of criticism of this moratorium, saying that it's bankrupting landlords and causing tenants who cannot pay to stay in properties for a really long time. But really, I don't think that really was the case in Idaho, from especially with the numbers that they dropped and how little it was enforced. I think any landlord in Idaho during this time of moratorium who wanted to evict could, And there were many evictions mm-hmm. in Idaho that happened. You know, you were seeing like 30-ish a week, you know, happening in the Treasure Valley, I believe, during, you know, during that moratorium, you know, so that right. it kind of played out a little differently than some people have said it has.
Kevin, lots of folks putting their hat in the ring for some political positions.
Hard to believe it, but we're barely a year away from the next yeah. round of primaries, and it's starting to heat up a little bit. Mary Souza, a state senator from Coeur d'Alene, announced this week that she's going to run for Secretary of State, which is probably going to be an open seat. Secretary of State Lawrence Denny has indicated that he's not going to he's most likely not going to seek re-election. It's not official. Mm. So you have Mary Souza has announced for this race on the Republican side. So is Ada County Clerk Phil McGrane. A little bit of a dust up this week involving a campaign announcement that wasn't. Brandon Durst, a Republican from Boise who's running for state superintendent, state school superintendent, sent out a tweet welcoming State Board of Education President Debbie Critchfield into the race. Debbie Critchfield has not yet announced that she's running. There are a lot of rumors that she may run. We've heard these rumors for quite some time, but she's not officially made a decision about running for state superintendent. She hasn't appointed a campaign treasurer, which is a precursor to formally filing paperwork, which candidates can't do until the first part of next year anyway. But we're 13 months away from the Republican primary, and the jockeying is already underway.
Oh, it just, it hurts my head to think about it because it's 13 months away.
but we're ready because we just got out of an election. We're primed.
I know.
It's like,
we really are. Yeah, we're just sliding back into the mix. Margaret, so, you know, so much has been talked about the Idaho, the Expo Idaho site. What to do with it, you know, et cetera. So what's going on in regards to a new survey to actually get people's input?
Yeah, so if you're not familiar, the Expo Idaho site is where they host the Western Idaho Fair. It's where the Boise Hawks play. It's 247 acres, and a lot of it is pretty underutilized especially after the LeBois racetrack closed. Mm-hmm. You've got those kind of creepy horse stalls, and it's just a kind of an underutilized property, and so the county is trying to figure out what they want to do with it. And over the last year, they had a stakeholder committee put together some ideas, some concepts, and now they're going to put that out into the community and let the community kind of decide. And so the three concepts, which they're hoping to mix together into kind of a best of both worlds, is they're wondering if people would prefer an agriculture focus, you know, with the fair and places for agriculture education and activities to take place, maybe some farm to table restaurants, or a concept that's really focused on sports and recreation with a new Boise Hawks stadium complex, sports fields, you know, park open space. Mm-hmm. And then the third concept is a town center that would kind of be almost like the village, where we've got housing, we've got shops, walkable, bikeable, almost like a little downtown for Garden City, because Garden City does not have a downtown. And so they're basically asking residents to get on the survey, which you can access on the Ada County Development Services website, and rank your choices. Do you like a stadium more than you like a park space? Or do you want the fairgrounds to move or stay? Do you like the stadium? You know, all these different choices. And then they're going to analyze them and come back and refine what they want to do for the site.
And then, Keith, I mean, it wouldn't be a roundtable without talking about COVID and our vaccine rollout. But can you update us on the latest on a lawsuit in regards to Idaho's vaccine rollout?
Yeah, federal lawsuit. You know, what's kind of interesting about this one, it just sort of exemplifies this kind of pervading and underlying, you know, sense of fear and uncertainty people have been living with for more than a year now here in Idaho with this pandemic. And Richard Byrd, 87, lives in Rogerson, South Central Idaho. He filed the lawsuit in January because he felt that he wasn't in the vaccine line as early as he should be. As you might remember, back then in January, when the vaccine first came out in Idaho, it was the it was healthcare providers and people living in long-term care facilities. Richard Byrd, again, 87, doesn't live in a long-term care facility, said it wasn't fair. He couldn't get the vaccine. He also argued that healthcare workers tend to be younger and healthier and more likely to survive. So he filed the lawsuit. The state is trying to have it thrown out. This week, they filed some documents, one thrown out on some technical grounds. But they're also asked the judge to require Mr. Byrd to say whether or not he has received the vaccine. He actually became eligible for it on February 1st. And in fact, the timetable for vaccines has sped way up right now. In most of the state, anybody 16 or over who wants the vaccine can get it. But you know, Byrd hasn't said whether or not he's gotten the vaccine. I tried to talk to him the day I wrote the story. He didn't call me, but he did call me this morning. And I chatted with him for a little while, too late for the story I wrote earlier this week. But I asked him if he had gotten the vaccine, and he declined to comment.
Interesting.
Yeah, sounds like an interesting character. And he plans on still fighting on this thing. He actually asked the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to intervene as well and speed things up, but they declined. So it'll be interesting to see how this goes. Of course, if he has the vaccine, the state would argue that the case is a moot and they'd ask for it to be tossed as well.
Right, of course. Hey, Kevin, we've got about a minute left. What's going on with high school students getting set to take the SATs?
Well, about 23,000 high school juniors will take the SAT in a couple of weeks, and they'll do it during the regular school day, and they'll do it at state expense. This is a program that we've had in place for several years. It was put on hold because of the pandemic. But the question remains really about whether what the future is for this program. Because right now, Idaho colleges and universities aren't requiring the SAT as an admissions requirement. A lot of universities and colleges around the country are rethinking the SAT as a requirement. It's unclear going forward whether the SAT will be a college admissions requirement for Idaho institutions. So a lot remains to be seen on it, but kids will be taking the test this month.
Lucky them. Hey, you guys, thanks so much for your time. We've been talking, I still remember those SATs. We've been talking to Kevin Risher with Idaho Education News, Margaret Carmel with BoiseDev.com, Nick Geranis with the Associated Press in Spokane joined us for our first segment, and Keith Riddler with the Idaho Associated Press. Happy Friday, guys. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks, Gemma.
Thank you.
Thanks. More Idaho Matters next.